From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a potato.
Another mass shooting has claimed 10 lives in Oregon, and the Russians are bombing Syria, and they don't appear to be attacking ISIS. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, correspondent for The Upshot at The New York Times. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. And on the left is Chris Hayes, host of All In with Chris Hayes on MSNBC. Our special guest is Kelly Goff, columnist for The Daily Beast. Welcome to all of you. So on Thursday, as you've surely seen, there was a mass shooting at Umpqua Community College in southwestern Oregon. The shooter was ultimately killed in a shootout with police. Absurdly, we've all gotten kind of used to the conversations we have after mass shootings, but I want to drill down on something that people always seem to say after these events that I think is less wise than people think. That is, people always say we need to do something about mental health. Now, it's possible there are good policy reasons unrelated to the problem of mass shootings for changing mental health policy, but I'm very skeptical that we could use mental health policy to materially reduce the likelihood of attacks like Thursday's. So before I go into why I'm down on this idea, do any of you want to speak up for it? What would an effective mental health approach to mass shootings look like?
Yeah, I'll stick up for it. I think you're right. It's not going to make a difference in most of these shootings, but there are occasionally cases, the Virginia Tech shooter, for instance, clearly psychotic. His parents, his classmates, his teachers afraid of him. And he actually came to the attention of mental health authorities and just fell through the cracks. And the reason I want to reform the system is perhaps it makes a difference at the margins with some of these mass shooters. But the main reason, it'll be an enormous benefit to seriously mentally ill people who in the aggregate have gone from institutions 30 or 40 or 50 years ago that were horrible to prisons now, which aren't any better.
Yeah, I actually 100% agree with that last part. We have, if you look at the rates of institutionalization in the U.S., if you overlay the mental illness institutionalization with incarceration, it basically looks like we transferred a bunch of people from mental institutions to prison. In terms of the specifics, though, the Virginia Tech is the case that sticks out the most. But I think that is very small at the margins generally.
And also, for the record, it's not just about them being moved from institutions to prisons, but not being helped at all. I mean, particularly here in New York, a big part of, you look at our homeless population, it's people who have mental health issues and are not being helped. There's nothing to stop that person from walking in and purchase a firearm or using a brick and assaulting a woman, which is something that also happens. So it's a relevant conversation. I think what we can't seem to quite agree on is what the solution is.
Right.
When it comes to violence.
I think all of that is fair, but I think there's a key thing that arose in that, which is basically that all the approaches we've had to this were terrible. Mass institutionalization of people with mental illness was cruel, didn't work, was a huge infringement on civil liberties. Also, I feel like important to note in these conversations, the vast, vast majority of people with mental illness are not going to commit a mass shooting and indeed are not even the overwhelming majority.
Right.
So, yes, there are people out there who are not being helped who would be good if we helped. But from my vantage point, it looks like the usual reason people with mental illness are not helped, the main usual reason is that they do not want to be. And I think it's very difficult to devise effective government interventions that get them help without doing things like we had with mass institutionalization decades ago.
There's also, when we hear, I was thinking about this last night. We hear there's a phrase that gets inserted about keeping the guns out of the hands of the mentally ill. Well, that's an easy phrase to utter. That is a tough phrase to statutorily define or to come up with like the coherent category. I mean, someone suffering from depression or anxiety or in certain very extreme cases of the Virginia Tech shooter where there's someone who clearly seems to be going through intense psychosis that is terrifying to the people in his circle. Okay, fine. That's a fairly clear example. But when you start to expand out that category, that starts to get very, very tricky.
So, and what Chris just touched upon is one of, people keep pointing to Australia as an example of reform that works. President Obama has brought it up. Okay, but the thing about a place like Australia is they did
just
things.
Just describe briefly what they did in Australia.
Well, there were a laundry list of things, but among them was a national registry after they had a really bad mass shooting there. Permits that have to be reapplied for every 5 years that indicate why you need a firearm, and just saying, I feel like I need protection is not enough of a reason to say that you need a firearm. And so But what that kind of gets at fundamentally is this idea that not everyone has the need for a firearm and that specific people based on behavior should not have them in their homes. That's really what it gets at, which, of course, is very complicated here in the U.S. because I could make a compelling case that someone who said, I hate Kelly Goff, she's a terrible writer, and I never want to be in the vicinity of her, should not be allowed to have a firearm if they're living in the same building as me, and have kind of hinted at threats. And if I say that that person seems mentally unstable, but in our country, when it comes to actually executing how you keep guns, how you determine, that's where things get foggy.
If I could also just say, I mean, I think there is an impulse to think in the wake of this, we know nothing about the shooter, right? That there must have been some mental illness. I mean, it's possible there wasn't in any diagnosable form. It's possible that we are staring into the face of, you know, evil, for lack of a better or more sort of cogent word. The other thing I'll say is, if you're looking at sort of probability rates and fatalities, and if you're looking at mass shooting in the broad category, right, like multiple gunshots, multiple fatalities, most of them are men shooting women and hitting other people in homes. That is what most mass shootings, and a lot of those people get guns despite significant records of domestic violence. They have, you know, they have pled to them, they have misdemeanors, right. They have felonies. That is actually where the bulk of this is happening.
Just back on the mental health, there is a lot of room between what we're doing now and kind of the one flew of a cuckoo's nest image of mental institutions. You have case after case of parents with a psychotic child whose part of their illness is refusing the treatment, you know, locked away in their basement, and the only way you can get this person help is if they're in imminent danger to themselves or someone else, which basically is a standard the way it's interpreted that requires them to commit a violent act or attempt to commit suicide. And you have these parents caught in this horrible moral dilemma, oftentimes lying to the police about what their children have done and saying their children have attacked them when they haven't, just to get them help. That makes zero sense.
So I want to touch on something that Kelly said a little while back about, you know, deciding who has a purpose for a firearm. Because it seems like broadly when you look around the world, there are two sets of possible policies you can have about guns. One is where there's a presumption that you are entitled to own a gun unless you for some reason are prohibited. In the U.S., we have, you know, if you've committed a felony, various other things, you could imagine a more restrictive list. You could imagine restrictions around mental illness. But basically, since it's the burden is on somebody to show that that person shouldn't have a gun, you're going to have a lot of people who you fail to identify as being people that you should have blocked. And some of these people who will commit mass shootings or who much more commonly will commit non-mass shootings won't be identified. The alternative that you see in Japan and various other places is basically that the presumption is that you don't get to have a gun and you have to demonstrate some reason why you should get to have it. And there are the opposite kind of errors there. There are certain people who probably ought to be able to have a gun who wouldn't be dangerous to people who will not be approved through those mechanisms. And you can debate back and forth which of those is better, but it seems clear to me that that structure is just inconsistent with the Second Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. We can't have a policy that starts from a presumption that people don't get to have a gun or that the government will basically look out and decide, you know, whether you're worthy and only if approved you can get one. And it's also clearly just inconsistent with where U.S. politics are. So I guess if those sorts of solutions are off the table, what is available that would really materially reduce gun violence in the United States if we have to start from the presumption that you get to own a gun unless the government can come up with a really good reason why you shouldn't?
Well, I'm wondering if anyone here has a law degree, because I don't. But I've always been baffled in terms of the interpretation of the Second Amendment because of the way it invokes a militia. And so whenever I read it, I don't actually think that it's been 100% clarified that everyone needs a firearm unless they're trying to arm a militia.
Well,
has anyone?
There's a Supreme Court case about this. Well, the Supreme Court found that there is an individual right. Obviously, I mean, there's
yes. You know, I mean, Heller and Miller are the two recent decisions in the last decade that essentially,
the one that, about the D.C.
That's right, D.C. and then the Illinois ruling. Follow-up. But both of those, you know, John Paul Stevens he wrote a book about amending the Constitution, and there's an excerpt of one of those chapters in the Washington Post today about his take on the Second Amendment and what it means. He wrote the dissent in Heller, which I, for biased reasons, find massively persuasive. But he, basically, I think if you're taking Heller as the law of the land, right, the Supreme Court's interpretation of it as an individual right, that does constrain what you can do. That said, the things that are being proposed that were proposed after, say, Newtown, closing the gun show loophole, for instance, I think even waiting periods, those are would pretty clearly clear the Heller bar. They would not be the court would uphold them. And I think there's good reason to suggest that that would, in the aggregate, reduce gun violence.
But by how much do you think? Like, are we?
I think it's hard to say. I mean, look, part of the issue with the broad issue when you zoom out is that we just have more guns per capita. We are a country that is just swimming in guns. I mean, we just have a lot more guns than anywhere else. I think a number. It's us in Iraq and Yemen, right up near the top. There's 300 million guns in the U.S. You also have a situation in the U.S. in which the percentage of households owning guns has declined over time, while the number of guns has increased. So you have fewer and fewer people buying more and more guns. That's going to create a tremendous amount of black market leakage when you have 300 million firearms.
Well, and I guess what I was trying to get at in bringing up the interpretation of the Second Amendment is I actually do think that if another case is brought, it will address exactly what you were asking about, Josh, which is this idea of how do we define, if we agree that you have an innate right to owning a firearm, how do we define who has that right? For instance, you have an innate right to vote in this country until you become a convicted felon, right? There's room for interpretation, and I just think that there has to be a gray area. For instance, there was the recent court case finding that a spouse can threaten his wife on Facebook, and that's not considered an imminent threat. Well, do we also agree that that person, I don't know if you guys saw that case, but there was a case where she said he was stalking her by saying, you know, I wish my wife or my ex were dead.
He was putting up rap lyrics.
Yeah. Well, okay, that's it.
That said, I wish my wife were dead. That's why it got tricky.
So, but should someone like that have the right to then drive to a store, buy a firearm and say, I really hate my ex. That's why, you know, I'm buying a firearm because I really hate my ex. Is that,
well, so, Rich, where do you approach this? As, I mean, given that, you know, the U.S. is necessarily going to have this model where it's, you know, presumption of a right to own a firearm with you know, specific categories who can't. The NRA has been very resistant to incremental change in that area, to expansions of the background check regime, things like that. What's the reason for essentially the no expansion view on the right here?
Well, because it's an important individual right that's written into our Constitution, and you want to avoid, if possible, infringing on that right. And the fact is, if we're talking about mass shootings, none of these things would make a difference reliably, just none of them. In most of these cases, the shooter, because he or she, he hasn't been in jail and hasn't been adjudicated, passes a background check.
Well, we don't know that.
And most of them, it's true. And the only thing that could really make a dent is if you did an Australian-style campaign of gun confiscation. And that's not going to happen. And still, even if you soaked up a lot of them, 100 million, you'd still have 200 or 250 million. And just another broad gauge point here, excuse the unintended pun, is that gun violence is down since the 1990s. At the same time, the number of guns has proliferated.
Can I just
gun violence is down because all violence is down. Gun violence has not fallen faster than regular violence. In fact, there's some evidence to indicate it has sort of bucked some of those trends. So violence in the aggregate, everything, you know, crime, burglaries, everything is down
but
over that same period of time.
If guns themselves drive crime, gun violence wouldn't have gone down. It would have gone up with the proliferation of guns. It hasn't.
I think that's a – here's what I would say. I think that I don't think anyone says there's some magic wand. I think the literature suggests that in the aggregate, at the margin, making guns more difficult to acquire will, in the aggregate, reduce incidences of gun violence. Will it make the U.S. look like comparable OECD countries? No, and that's not going to happen unless a real radical change.
Let us know what you think about preventing gun violence at kcrw.com/LRC. Up ahead, Russian attacks in Syria. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC.
Are you thinking about buying a new car? Consider donating your old one to KCRW and support the unique mix of news, music, and culture you love. You'll become a KCRW member and get a nice tax write-off. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow of the New York Times. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Chris Hayes of MSNBC and The Nation magazine, and Kelly Goff of The Daily Beast is also with us. So this week, Russia started conducting airstrikes in Syria, and though the Russians have couched this as a fight against ISIS, their attacks did not occur in ISIS-controlled areas. According to American officials, some of the strikes were actually against rebel forces the CIA has trained to fight Syrian President Assad. So this is a mess. I look at it with no idea what we should be doing about it. What do we do now?
Well, one, it was always a fantasy that we're going to have some sort of alliance with the Russians against ISIS. The reason they are in Syria is to bolster their ally, Bashar Assad. And Assad has been playing this cold-eyed game from the beginning, which is to attack the other rebels besides ISIS, so he seems like the lesser evil compared to ISIS. And Syria is now so far gone, there aren't really good solutions. I would do as much as we can to arm and train the Free Syrian Army, which is clearly there still in some form since the Russians feel compelled to bomb it. I'd consider all this would be a momentous step, some sort of safe haven within Syria, which might help strategically, certainly might help in the humanitarian situation. And then more broadly against Russia, I think it's just an open and shut case. We should be providing arms to the Ukrainians to at least increase the price, the cost to Russia of their aggression against the Ukrainians, and doing all we can to fortify the Poles and the Baltic states, because the Baltics might be the next on his target list, which would involve a conflict with NATO, which would make all of this look like small beer.
So what Donald Trump has been saying about this week.
God.
Sorry.
Just couldn't help yourself, could you?
I couldn't. Well, hey, you're
every
one to
conversation
talk,
comes back to Trump.
Build a wall between Nusra and...
No. That's way more intervention than Donald Trump
you
wants.
Hire the right people.
His view is basically, let them fight. Let the Russians bomb in Syria and, you know, just let these forces fight it out with each other and then see who's left standing and deal with the pieces that are there to pick up afterward. And that's obviously nihilistic, but I think the truth that lays at the bottom of it is that it is completely unclear which side American interests lie on here. I mean, when we look at the attempt that our government made to train vetted rebels in Syria, and we ended up with 4 people, because we had such difficulty identifying people who were both confident and reliably aligned with U.S. interests. Obviously Assad is really terrible, and obviously ISIS is really terrible. I'm just really skeptical of the idea that there is an element in here that we can prop up and be confident that after this all shakes out, they will be favorable to us. I mean, when you look at what happened in Libya, we are not better off with the current regime in Libya than we were with Gaddafi in Libya.
Yeah, I mean, the Libya, when you think about American spectrums of intervention in the Middle East in the last decade, 15 years, right? And you look at Iraq, Libya, and Syria, right? Iraq was a full-scale invasion, boots on the ground. Libya was a no boots on the ground, but a very, you know, a huge amount of air power brought to bear and regime change. Syria was essentially non-intervention with some stuff on the margins. It's hard to run those 3 experiments and say, you know, any of those worked very well. I mean, to me, the thing that I find, there's 2 things I can come up with. I can't pretend to even begin to have a view of the right strategic way forward in Syria, because it seems like such a mess. The 2 things that seem clear to me are the following. One is we should take a ton of refugees, that we have the space, we have the ability, we have the resources. We also, I think, probably should be releasing some of the pressure that's going to come onto Europe, which I think can have some really negative effects. And that's a clear, moral, doable thing that we can do that isn't as complicated as finding the right moderate rebels to back. And then the other thing, the other thing that's clear to me, you know, sort of clear to me, is that it's very hard for me to imagine increasing the amount of arms flowing into Syria in any way bringing about a good resolution in the near term. I mean, the sort of half steps that we've taken, which have all been kind of seemingly against the will of the White House, understandably, it's all ended up with 11 or 12 countries bombing Syria, huge amounts of arms shipping into Syria. And everything I've heard from folks in the sort of Syrian human rights community don't seem to think that, like, more weapons flowing in have been helpful.
It also seems to me like that's especially true now that the Russians are bombing, because before you could have imagined a best case scenario where you find the good rebels, you arm them, they manage to depose Assad or at least control more territory and rescue more people from Assad. But now, if you know, to the extent you strengthen those people, the Russians are just going to bomb their positions. It seems to me like, you know, the worst case scenarios where the arms fall in the wrong hands are still available. The best case scenarios are significantly impaired. So, Kelly, you had something to say.
Well, I was just going to say the late great Julian Bond, when I interviewed him, once said about both politics and policy that rarely does it offer you a great choice and a better choice, but usually it's just a choice and a worse choice. And that's kind of seems to be the situation here, which is the fact that no one seems to know, I think, including the White House, the answer to your question explains why things are quite such a mess.
But the Trump plan, if I can use that word for it, is basically what we've been doing. And it's been an utter disaster on every level. It's led to more radical gains on the ground, because when you have civil war spinning out of control like this, mm-hmm. the moderates don't win. It's the radicals who gain. So it's been one of the predicates for the rise of ISIS. And as far as more arms into Syria, it does make a difference who you're arming or not. And the
right,
experience in the war in the Balkans is, if you're ultimately going to have a negotiated solution, it matters very much how your allies are actually performing and what kind of territory they are holding. So if we just cede this to Russia and they bomb the moderates out of existence, that is not going to be a step towards a solution.
Right, but let me say this. I mean, as ISIS at this moment rides around in American Humvees, the arms that you are the initial people that you ship your arms to do not stay in the hands of those people. In fact, we have seen this time and time again. ISIS actually has a tremendous amount of U.S. armaments that went into Iraq. So that battlefield is as chaotic and dynamic as any battlefield in the world right now. It has been for a very long time. I just think that the idea that there is a large enough group of tactically equipped enough people to sort of hold this middle moderate position at this point just seems, maybe it's true, but it seems like,
well, we have
extremely
those,
unlikely.
We have those five guys, because, right. because the five guys we vetted, we wanted them just to fight ISIS. And there's no one who is interested in
That's
doing
right.
that
That's
when
right.
you've had
yep.
this Alawite massacring the yep. entire country.
Yes.
And the Free Syrian Army, I still think, is much more of a viable force. And again, they're still there because they're getting bombed.
Yep. So where is the... So I'll grant that was a restriction that was hamstringing us. But what's the example where we can look where the arming the rebels thing really worked? Because I think the Balkans is quite different. We just had a much greater level of intervention there.
Yep.
It's also in Europe, which and frankly, the people are perceived as white in Europe, which I think helps with the political sustainability of the intervention there. What's the example of where this...
Afghanistan during the Cold War, Nicaragua during the
Cold
War.
Well, play that out a bit. I mean, sure, yes, it worked for a little while until it stopped working.
No, it helped Badly. Bleed out the Soviet Union, which is a major thing. Nicaragua, you probably wouldn't have had a settlement in a democratic election unless you had a strong contra forces. The Kurds were rebels for a long time and actually managed to create probably, you know, one of the best governed countries or enclaves in the Middle East outside of Israel. So, the alternative is just to let Vladimir Putin smash anyone who's more moderate than ISIS.
So, well,
and why would we want to do that? And what's the enormous cost of arming? It's not as though we're going in and invading in the ground ourselves, which is a much more serious intervention.
Well, if we're to believe, though, Putin's spokesperson, he's only targeting ISIS and not a single civilian or anyone else is getting...
Well, also, but let's just be clear about, like, I think it's important to tease apart a few things in our discussion of Syria, right?
Yeah.
So there is, first of all, let's start with the most important thing, which is just the massive human suffering that this war has been. Hundreds of thousands of people dead, children being barrel bombed, beheading. I mean, literally, it is the worst maelstrom of a vortex of human misery and chaos that we have seen in a very long time. Like, it's basically rock bottom for humanity there. So that's the most important thing, right? So the question is, from my perspective, like, how do we alleviate that? Then there's a sort of kind of geostrategic question about, like, what are the American interests and how can we, you know, back the people that are on our side? And there's a whole bunch of strategic questions. And then I sense sometimes this sort of, like, how can we show we are strong? Mm-hmm. And, like, Putin showing he's strong and we're showing we're weak. And that I find the least compelling, I have to say, because I feel like the arguments come to, in the American domestic political context, tend to resonate in that register. And there's a lot of dumb things you can do well, out of desiring to appear strong.
And the super strange thing about that is that Russia is in, on most important metrics, quite weak right now. They have immense economic problems. They're hugely dependent on oil, which has fallen immensely in price. And so, Rich, when I look at what you brought up about Russian aggression around the world, I'm worried about that too. But on the other hand, I have to think this has to prove unsustainable for them eventually. How many of these wars can they afford to fight while they're economy is in an immense recession? It would seem eventually that the Russian people would be not so interested in foreign adventures in Ukraine and Poland and anywhere else.
They're very interested.
Exactly. But that's because, weird, right?
It's not that weird. It's because the register that Chris was talking about resonates with people. And it's very important for Vladimir Putin to directly and with malice aforethought humiliate the president of the United States, because the people at home love it. They love it. They love the idea of strength in Ukraine. They love the idea of being back in the Middle East. And the Syrian intervention, at least on the current trajectory, is not going to be terribly expensive for them. You have Iranian proxies and Hezbollah, who are the ones on the ground providing the cannon fodder while Russia does the bombing.
We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Kelly Goff, what's your rant?
Well, I have to start by saying, in a week of the shooting, I get so sick and tired of hearing the NRA hide behind the Second Amendment. It's like people forgot that the Constitution had to be changed so that I, as a black woman, would have the right to vote and be treated as a citizen in this country. But lastly, Brookings Institution has a new report out about the plight of unmarriageable men and the women who can't find spouses. And I have a piece out for Elle magazine about the fact that the reason I don't have a spouse and a child is because I don't want them right now. So,
Chris Hayes,
so please stop worrying about us unmarried women.
Chris Hayes, what's on your mind?
Okay, so Oklahoma stayed the execution of Richard Glossop at the 11th hour. I mean, actually after the deadline had passed. The attorney general now saying it's indefinite. This is a state that has had four death row exonerations and had one of the worst botched executions in recent memory, that found out at the last minute they'd acquired the wrong drug. Everyone involved with running that operation should resign in disgrace at this point. It is an abomination.
Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
A score of climate scientists have called for a RICO investigation of so-called climate skeptics. If they're truly as confident as they profess to be in their own position and are really want disinterested debate over this question, they shouldn't be trying to criminalize their opponents.
For my rant, Hillary Clinton called this week for the repeal of the so-called Cadillac tax in Obamacare. This is the 40% excise tax on high-priced health plans. Nobody loves a 40% tax, obviously, but this much unloved policy is actually a very good policy. It offsets this insane policy we have of massively subsidizing the employer purchase of healthcare for employees that immensely drives up healthcare costs. It just sets a cap on that. For plans that are about 50% more expensive than normal, you start losing that tax advantage. It's a good policy, but unions don't like it, and Republicans don't like anything to do with Obamacare, so I fear that there will be a political coalition to undo it, and that will just mean higher healthcare prices for all of us. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Kelly Goff, and Chris Hayes. We taped today at Argo Studios in New York City. Laura Dine Million produced today's program. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Sarah Singer Schiff is our production assistant. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download the podcast from KCRW.com or from iTunes and share your comments at KCRW.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.